Yeah, I guess we can get started. And if anyone else wanders in, they wander in. So this was listed as a social learning to culture lecture, but when we went and looked at the schedule, we realized that Ian Cousin was doing another lecture along those lines later in the term. So what the group decided was to ask me to come and give this lecture on physical cognition or physical intelligence. So I've just recently moved here. I run the Cognitive and Cultural Ecology Research Group at the Max Planck, and the last 7 years I've been in Oxford in the UK. And this is the lecture as part of the animal cognition course that I used to give undergrads, third year undergrads there. And so I've modified it a bit, recognizing that you don't do quite as much work on animal cognition and behavior here, but hopefully you'll still be able to follow along and find it interesting. And if you have any questions or I'm hard to understand because I know I have an accent, then just stick up your hand or shout at me, just holler down at me. So what I'm going to start with is the first half talking about tool use in animals. And then on the second half, I'm going to move to talking about problem solving, what we call physical cognition, the solving of physical problems, and innovation in animals. So, and hopefully you'll see how they tie together. So to start with tool use. So the first times tools, so can we see this or should I turn the lights on? You can see it? Okay. The first time tool use was first observed in animals was by Jane Goodall with the famous Gombe chimpanzee community in Africa doing this sort of termite fishing behavior where they stick sticks down holes and pull out ants. And at the time, this was unthinkable because we actually defined humans as tool-using animals. So Louis Leakey, the famous archaeologist at the time, said to Jane Goodall that given this, we must now redefine tool, redefine man, or accept chimpanzees as humans. And so what we did was redefine man, and it became a definition about bipedalism and etc. But this was just the start. So even in the same chimpanzee community, over their decades of observations, they've now put together an enormous list of tool use behavior. I think it's coming up to something like 50 different ways in which they use tools. Nuts cracked by stones, different, they use sponges to soak up water to then squeeze into their mouth, and a wide variety of ways we can see tool use. And this sort of starting work on tool use was sort of suggestive of the idea that it must have something to do with complex cognition. We're seeing it in chimpanzees. We used to think it was to do in humans. And so the work started being researched, or the research started happening by anthropologists and by cognitionists and psychologists interested in what cognition, what intelligence was involved in tool use. But this has sort of become very controversial. And in fact, when people started to look for tool use, we saw it in a much wider variety of species than you might think. And it really forced us to start to sort of argue and debate what actually is tool use. Maybe instinctively we think we know what tool use. This is a tool, your pencil is a tool. But are anything more than this tool use? Can we extend it to a wider context? For example, is this tool use? So this is a heron, and it's taken a piece of bread. Some of you might have heard of this behavior. And it puts the bread in the water to attract fish. And then when the fish come and eat the bread, it can grab the fish. And so it's not interested in the bread itself. And in fact, it's kind of widely seen in sort of parks across Europe that herons and egrets will steal bread and actually take it to catch fish. So is that a tool? Are they using the bread as a tool in this case? Hopefully at some point it will catch a fish. Well. Success. Well, maybe not success. Anyway. And then I guess we could extend it further. So we've got an example of tool use to catch food. But is this tool use? So this is a palm cockatoo in Australia. And it was recently published about 2 years ago, this what they call drumming display. So the cockatoos will break off a stick, take it to their nest hollow, and then drum in the nest hollow to attract females through the noise, because it carries much further, as you can imagine, exactly like a drum, using this hollow chamber than just calling. Is that tool use? It's not for foraging purposes. Is this tool use? This is not a vertebrate. Now we're going quite far, but it's an invertebrate that many of us consider to have perhaps complex cognition. And this was published last year in Current Biology, the observations that what they call these coconut-carrying octopus will find coconut shells and then use them as defensive, basically, shells. So they'll carry them around with them and hide underneath them. And you can even get observations where they'll collect multiple shells and carry both at the same time to basically form a complete coconut around them. So is that tool use? If so, we're now extending it to invertebrates. And then to really push the boat out, you could ask whether this is tool use. Certainly, that's what the authors claim, but this one's very controversial. So to explain this a little bit more, this is Atlantic cod, and they're in a fishery, so they're in captivity, being reared for food. And they tag all of the cod with these little tags at the top that you can see that stick out of the flesh. And in addition to that, completely unrelated, they have a feeder for the cod. So the feeder works by the cod pulling on a string with their mouth, and the light comes on and they get food. And this is the way the cod feed themselves in this situation. But what the researchers observed was that they were innovating a more efficient way to get the food. They use their tag, and they hook their tag around the string, and they pull the string, and then they get food, as you can see in this photograph, in this drawing down here. So they're using something that's not part of their body to get food in this case, but they haven't gone and found that tool. It's attached to them. Is that tool use? I think this is starting to become a very grey area. So researchers have tried to define what we could possibly mean by it. So let's start with that, see if we can kind of expand this picture out. So Jane Goodall, who I mentioned earlier, who I'm sure you all know, gave us the first definition of tool use from her observations of chimpanzees in Gombe. And she said that a tool use, or a tool, was the use of an external object as a functional extension of the mouth or beak or hand or claw to attain an immediate goal. But she specified that the object had to be held. So that would cut out the cod. It might also cut out some of the other examples I showed you, for example, the heron we're using, putting the bread in the water. So we've gone all the way since then to very broad definitions that try to be very inclusive. For example, in Reed in 95, he said, an object used for acquiring or conserving energy more efficiently than an individual or social group could do without it. But once we extend it this far, we start to realize this includes nests, includes burrows, it includes spider webs. It even includes another individual that you could use to conserve energy more efficiently by huddling up next to them. So once we start to think about burrows as tools, you know, have we really got anywhere further than just describing animal behaviour? And at the other end of the spectrum, we have very narrow definitions. For example, Jeffrey, the concept of tool is essentially and inseparably associated with the concept of a hand. So that seems a bit harsh. Nothing that doesn't have a hand, like nothing without hands can use tools, or anything without hands can use tools. We have even Matuzawa, who's a very famous Japanese chimpanzee researcher, stating very explicitly, tool use is limited to primates, full stop. Which is, as a bird researcher, isn't exactly my favourite way to define things taxonomically. And Van Schaik, who works on orangutans, Intelligence explains why in the wild only apes are known to make and use tools routinely. Well, okay, so that's a little bit circular, I would argue, if we're saying that tool use indicates something about intelligence, but we're defining tool use as something only intelligent animals do. And the evidence is now becoming increasingly clear that many other animals do use tools routinely. For example, that cockatoo I showed, that parrot, that's part of their usual mating display, is to drum with that stick. So I think the definition that we basically decided, or as a community we've kind of come around to, and definitely the one that I prefer, is that of Shoemaker in 2011. And he suggested that it was the external employment of an unattached or manipulable attached object to alter more efficiently the form, position, or condition of another object or another organism, or the user itself. And the user has to hold or directly manipulate this object and is a sort of in charge of it, so it's effectively steering or orientating it. And to break this down, here we have four distinct elements. So the animal can externally employ an unattached or even an attached object, but something that's separate to them, to alter something else, to alter the form, position, or condition of another object. And it holds it or directly uses it during the behavior. And it's sort of responsible. I mean, this is a very broad idea that an animal is responsible for something. But the animal is directing the orientation of the tool. So it's sort of, there's some intentionality involved in that. But even with that, I think we're at a point where there's no assumption here that it's to do with hands or primates or humans, and no assumption that it's in any particular form or that it's used routinely, for example, or passed on between individuals like humans do. And actually, this has then opened a real can of worms. So now we no longer say chimpanzees are special, they use tools. Well, first we said humans were special, they use tools. Then we said chimpanzees were special, they use tools. And then we found these tools in everything else. And this has sort of led us to the point where we say, well, do we have to redefine how we think about tool use? Is there any actual cognition involved in tool use? So are animals that are using tools understanding what they're doing? Is there some sort of link between intelligence and tool use? And is there anything cognitively special at all about tool-using species? Not necessarily in terms of general intelligence, but in terms of maybe they've got specialized cognition or intelligence for this sort of behavior, for this sort of tool use. And so this links to what I was mentioning before at the beginning of the lecture, the idea of physical cognition, physical intelligence, intelligence for the manipulation of physical items, as opposed to, say, for example, vocal intelligence, complex language. So, as I mentioned before, tool use is, although we're finding good examples of it, relatively rare in other animals. And we use tools all the time. We love tools. And so this has led some to assume that tool use has to include some aspect of intelligence or causal understanding. For example, in 2009, we had Finn saying, "The use of tools is a benchmark for cognitive sophistication. Originally regarded as a defining species, a feature of our species, to date, invertebrates have been regarded as lacking in cognitive abilities to engage in sophisticated behavior." Well, yes, except we do have examples from octopus. So maybe we just call them something different? So we can say that this may be the case. However, we don't actually need any special sort of learning involved in tool use. So the evidence from this species that I'll go into, the next three species, is that tool use can be acquired with associative learning. So this is basically trial and error learning. You try something, you get a reward, you try it again, and that makes you refine it over time. So this is what we call, there's an association building between the reward and the behavior, so associative learning, and or social learning. So this is learning by observing another individual. And in addition to this, so this is the evidence we see from New Caledonian crows, the evidence from some other species, like woodpecker finches, which I'll show you later. These are a Galapagos Island finch that use stick tools. The evidence from them suggests that it could possibly be even genetically fixed. So you might not need any learning at all to use tools. Or it could be something to do with flexible in cognition. And as in addition to that, it could be linked to morphology. So these two lines of evidence come from some of the work that's been done on parrots. So I'll go into these in the next half an hour. But I want to start with a broader question, which I think might relate more to the sort of undergrad learning you've been doing here. I understand it's very evolutionary focused. So I thought I would go into the question of, when does tool use evolve? So we have four non-mutually exclusive hypotheses. First, tool use may facilitate access to scarce and important resources. So maybe tool use evolves as a way of getting access to a food that you otherwise couldn't. Tool use may also enable colonization of new habitats. And so then once you're in that habitat, you go back to hypothesis one and you become reliant on tools because there's novel resources that you're not really, you haven't evolved to exploit in those habitats, so you're using the tool to access them. Tool use may improve the diet or provide niche requirements that you can't get from normal foraging, and this has particularly come from chimpanzee work. Or back to the sort of where I started, maybe it's not related to the ecology and evolution of species at all, it's just some indicator or byproduct of complex intelligence. So let's start with the most famous tool-using species. We've had one, the chimpanzee, but I'm a bird person, so I like to skip straight to the birds. So have you all heard of this species, the New Caledonian crow? No? Okay. So this is a bird found, it's a crow. I'm sure you all have all heard of crows. It's found in New Caledonia on an island which is very arid off the coast of Australia. And it's only found there. And it's famous amongst ecologists because this bird uses tools throughout its entire life and uses very complex tools as well. So the most famous behavior that they engage in is that of using stick tools to wiggle grubs out of these rotten trees. But in addition to this, they make hook tools where they either break apart a branch which already has a thorn on it and use that as a rake, or sometimes they can even bend sticks to make hooks and use that to hook insects and various things out of rotten wood. They can also use what are called pandanus tools. So they use the pandanus palms, which have these sort of grass trees with spiny sides, and they tear sections of them. And then in this way, they can make sort of a what looks like a stick tool, but it's got thorns all the way along it. So it's effectively like a comb that they can use to more easily grab onto their insect prey. So these are all observations that have been conducted in the wild, and this has puzzled ecologists for 30 years. How did New Caledonian crows acquire tool use like this? How are they so good at using so many different types of tools? And so this was the focus of a lot of work in Oxford over a number of years, where they had birds in captivity, and they did a variety of experiments, and I won't go into all of them, but one particularly important one, they had hand-reared birds, so young birds, and they gave them over a time of development either exposure to what they called tutors, so these were they were allowed to observe older birds that knew how to use tools already, or they were given no exposure to older birds. And they found that in some cases there was an improvement if they were given tutored individuals, so the individuals that were allowed to socially learn from others. But for many of their variables that they were measuring, there was no difference. So they appeared to it appeared to be the case that tool use kind of emerged over the development period of a New Caledonian crow, even if they weren't exposed to any other individuals. So there seems to be a really strong genetic component to this behaviour. But having tutors improved their learning speed and allowed them to acquire the tool use behaviour earlier. So basically, we seem to have a mix here. There's learning involved, but there's also some genetic predisposition. But having exposure to the tools and the observation of other individuals using tools improved their learning as well. So the main goal of this 6 years of research, or longer than that, at Oxford, was this was conducted by psychologists, and they really wanted to understand, or they wanted to try and show that sort of insight and reasoning and causal understanding was underlying this tool use behaviour in New Caledonian crows. So in their first observation of this bird called Betty the Crow, who was able to take wire and bend it in order to pick up a bucket, they suggested that, you know, she was able to invent a new method of shaping material into functional forms, and that she must have an image of this form in her head, so she's got clearly causal understanding of what she's doing. But by the end of the research in 2007, they were backtracking and saying, well, if we exchange the word invent for discover and preconceived for learned, there would no need to look beyond just really simple trial and error learning to explain tool use. And on the basis of this evidence, they can't exclude the possibility that apparently all intelligent behaviours shown by New Caledonian crows can just be explained by associative learning mechanisms that may be true for other non-human species. So, yeah, I guess some learning, but maybe not very complex. And interestingly, there's another part to this story. So in the wild, this is New Caledonia, there was a big survey conducted by some New Zealand researchers of the different tool types that they saw across the island. And they particularly focused on pandanus tools. So this is this what I was describing here. It's a pandanus leaf, and they can strip the edge to get this sort of thorny stick in a way. But they can do it in a number of possible ways. They can make it thin, they can make it fat, they can make it thin at one end, which is a bit more effective, like if you imagine a sort of spear-type shape they're making, or they can make it stepped, which is actually structurally very sound. So you can make it longer, which means you can extend it further into holes to get out insects. And when they did a survey of all these different tool types across the island, they actually found they were clustered. And what those authors suggested was that, which you'll get back to in the social learning and culture evolution lecture, that what we were observing here was different cultures of tool use, and more than that, that they were derived. So you had a very simple form of tool, and that it was becoming more complex over time. And so some areas had sort of culturally or socially learned, invented, and then culturally inherited a more complex form of the tool. But this is very controversial. So maybe a bit of left and a bit of right. So, and really interestingly, just 2 years ago, we had an expansion of this story. So this was supposed to be the only habitual tool-using crow. And the researchers that Christian Rutz's group in St. Andrews, who work on New Caledonian crows, actually went to another island nearby, I'm sure you've heard of this one, Hawaii, where there's an extinct Hawaiian crow that's now only exists in captivity. And they looked at those captive birds, because we have no knowledge of what they did in the wild, and they found that actually those captive birds use tools, and when given the opportunity, learn tools incredibly readily. And so what they were suggesting was that actually tool use existed, like New Caledonia, in the Hawaiian crows as well. And it was just the case that we didn't know about it because they were extinct by the time people started looking. So this led them to argue that there's something similar about these two birds, and they're only distantly related, so it can't be their phylogeny. And rather, what they think it is that there's something typical about islands that produces tools, users. So they suggested reduced competition, embedded prey, so sort of hard to reach prey, arid conditions that they were facing them, so a food shortage, and low predation risk that you often find on island species. And all of these things allowed the evolution of tools in these particular species. Obviously still rare, because not all island species use tools, but this is what they suggested these two species had in common. So it sort of tackles the first two and the third. I'm then going to give another example of one that's particularly looked at, this third example of whether tool use can improve diet or help you exist in niches you couldn't otherwise. And to do this, we turn to the woodpecker finch. So this is a bird found on the Galapagos Islands. It's one of Darwin's famous finches. And they live in this sort of habitat. So very dry and arid, and on a set variety of the Galapagos Islands. They're very small. We're talking just a little finch. But what they do is they take cactus thorns often, so these very little tools, and then they use them to insert them, like this, into trees and pull out insects. So very similar to the New Caledonian crows in the way they behave, just on a sort of micro scale. And not a bird you would assume was particularly intelligent. It's just a finch. It's not a big corvid. So there's been several years, many years actually, of research by Sabine Tepic on this group of woodpecker finches and some of the other related finches. And what she found is that looking at the foraging ecology of this species, that tool use is actually more costly than other techniques to get food. So why would you use tools when you could use another way to get food? Well, they actually use tools a lot more in dry conditions, in dry seasons, than they do in wet seasons. So they seem to be using tools when their food isn't, their normal food isn't very available. And in addition to this, they also tend to use tools more in the arid zone. So this is tool use here, and you can see it's still only a minority of their behavior, but it's much more common in the dry season in the arid zone. So this suggests again that it's something about maybe this is a suboptimal habitat for them and they're using tools to access resources when resources are scarce. So how do tool use develop in this species? Well, actually, when young birds were given a tutor that either used tools or didn't use tools, it made no difference whatsoever on their ability to learn to use tools. So again, there doesn't seem to be any social learning involved in this. We only see tools in the dry zone, in the arid zone, but while adults from the human zone brought into captivity can't learn to use tools, juveniles, young birds, can learn to use tools no matter which habitat they come from. So this suggests it's not genetically fixed specialization in the arid habitat, but rather it's learned, because juveniles that come from the other habitat where no tool use is observed can also learn it, but adults can't learn it from that habitat. So this suggests perhaps that what we have here is a sensitive phage in ontogeny. So juveniles appear to be able to learn this. They can't learn it when they become adults. And this is combined with the environmental influence of the need to use tools in particular habitat. And so it may be helping them with this sort of niche requirements. And the argument here is that generalist species with no morphological adaptations can use tools basically as a morphological adaptation. So they can gain resources which would otherwise be inaccessible for them by effectively creating a long claw by using a stick as a claw, for example. And actually, further evidence from this does come from chimpanzees. So chimpanzees seem to use tools particularly to get through the dry season and in periods of drought. So this is like when you see most of the tool use occurring. So again, it seems to be arguing for this sort of ecological role of tool use to access inaccessible resources. So if tool use has evolved as an adaptation to particular environmental conditions with genetic architecture underpinning it, then do we have any role for specialized cognition in this? Do we just have to throw out this idea that tool using species are more intelligent? Well, Sabin Tebbich compared tool using species with two closely related non-tool using species. So a New Caledonian crow with a hooded crow, a woodpecker finch with this, oh, I can't remember which one it is. It's one of the other Galapagos finches that doesn't use tools. And they tested the hypothesis that these particular tool-using species would be better at cognitive tasks which aren't particularly using tools, but where physical cognition is involved. So you have to understand the properties of the objects and manipulate objects. And in addition to this, they also tested them on tasks which just required general intelligence. And their hypothesis was that tool-using species would show an improvement on the physical cognition task, but not on the general intelligence task, over non-tool using species. So they use this sort of task where if you pulled this, you wouldn't get the food, but if you pull this, you would get the food. So you have to understand that there's something that's relating between this and this, that this is behind this. So kind of classic physical cognition task. And they found mixed results, unhelpfully. So New Caledonian crows outperform hooded crows, but there's no difference between the finches. And then I guess the final sort of argument for generalized cognition that's come from this literature has been in this species here. So this is the Goffin's cockatoo, and in Vienna, in the University of Vienna, they have a captive population of them and they do cognitive work on them. This species does not use tools, unlike this one. And in this species, they first observed, actually in 2012, a bird spontaneously start to make and use tools. So it was this bird here, one they called Figaro, and when nuts would fall outside the aviary onto this ledge and it couldn't reach them, it would get really frustrated and it started to break off wood from the bottom of the aviary and use it as a rake to try and rake the nut into the aviary. So when they realized this, they started tracking its behavior over time, and they found that these are the sorts of tools it made, that it seemed to be refining its tool use behavior over time, and it seemed to be, you know, really working hard to make good tools. So it's making multiple cuts on this branch in order to get the perfect sort of length, and it would refine the tool after. So it would try it and then it would take it back and cut it a bit and make it better. So having observed this strange behavior, they asked, okay, so can other Goffin's cockatoos learn to use tools by observing this one, given we know this isn't a tool-using species at all? And they did this experiment where they had Figaro, this bird, raking in out-of-reach food, and there's another bird watching it, and then the observer bird gets a chance to do it itself. And they had three conditions. Firstly, they observed this bird, like I said, but then secondly, they have what's called a control group, where there's a ghost. So a rake operated by magnets brings the food across, but you don't see another bird doing it. And then you have another condition where the food just comes into reach, but there's no tool involved. So these are sort of to control for an effect of just being in your attention drawn to the nut or your attention drawn to the stick without any actual influence of observing another bird. So here's the bird doing it, making a tool. Actually, Doolittle, different one. And now it's made a stick tool. And then it uses it as a rake and gets the food. And if I can get my pointer back. So here are some of the other birds that have learnt to use the tool, showing different techniques. So one of their findings was that there didn't appear to be exact imitation going on, because these birds seem to show different kind of ways of using these tools. So they were very innovative. So here's one kind of using it as a rake, like first one, but from above. I guess a brush, a broom.
Can you turn the brightness back up?
Let's see. Does that help? That probably makes it worse. There you go. Can you see it better now?
Yeah.
And this is my favorite tool use technique. So there's clearly a lot of sort of innovation going on there. It's not sort of genetically fixed behavior. At least it doesn't look like it. Is that too bright now? Should I? Anyway, we can turn it down again. And in fact, they did find that compared to these ghost conditions, the other birds were much more likely to learn when observing the first one. So yeah, there does seem to be some social learning involved in that. And they argued that this suggested that even though you may be in some species, you particularly in species where tool use is really habitual and important for their ecology, it might be genetically kind of fixed and there's not much flexibility. But in some of these kind of cognitively more complex species, like parrots argued to be, you can also have the sort of tool use as a cognitive flexibility, as an indicator of general intelligence. But there's a kind of a problem with this argument, which is that tool use, you can't, like with the original definition that you needed a hand to use tools, this seems really unfair because you might be the most intelligent octopus out there, but you're never going to have a hand. And again, in these sorts of studies, we see a sort of problem where there's species which have the sort of morphological adaptations to be able to grip things easier, are more able to use tools. And that's got nothing to do with intelligence or general intelligence. So a really good indication of this was this study. So they had a box where on this platform in the middle, there's food, and you could get to it using four different ways. And what they did was they would progressively shut off the options. So as soon as you learnt one, you had to go and do a different one. And they compared the ability to get the food out of this box between New Caledonian crows and keas. And keas are famously intelligent animals. They're those New Zealand parrots. So here's the New Caledonian crow having no problem whatsoever doing a string pulling task, and a kea. Also having no problem whatsoever. Has to roll a marble to get the food. So these are all tools. And again, you see no problem. But here is where it gets interesting. Stick task. New Caledonian crows use this all the time in the wild, and it has absolutely no problem solving this task. When you look at a kea, which isn't a tool-using species, and look at the trouble it's having to do this. It knows what it wants to do, but it just hasn't got the equipment. So I think this is a really good indicator of, or a good example of the link between morphology and tool use. And so what they actually found was that in these different tasks, so orange here is kea and blue is New Caledonian crow, The Kias outperformed the New Caledonian Crows in their learning of all of them but the stick task. And it's basically because they can't use sticks very easily. They've got a hooked bill that won't let them hold things straight, and it won't let them watch because their eyes are on the side of their head more than the crows. It won't let them watch what they're doing while holding it. So this sort of work led people to look more at these morphological adaptations in birds, and you can actually see in New Caledonian crows that they have a bill which is straighter than usual for a crow, and their eyes are more forward facing than usual for a crow, and this allows them to hold stick tools in as straight as possible way as you could do with a bill and manipulate them while you're actually able to watch what's going on. So they clearly, there's been a feedback between selection on morphology and this tool use behaviour in their evolutionary history. So the final word on tool use goes from to Louis Lefebvre, who's in Canada and does a lot of comparative studies. And he thought, well, okay, we've got lots of within species work on tool use, lots of ecological studies. Let's look at between species comparisons and see what we can find on this. And what he did was he collected all recorded incidences of tool use in the literature, and he divided them into what he called true tool use, the use of hammers, sponges, sticks, and what he called borderline cases, bait fishing, like we saw in the herons, dropping food on anvils like lamagayas do, where they take up bones and then drop them onto rocks to smash them, wedging food into rocks to access them more easily, things like this, where perhaps we would say, is that a tool? I'm not really sure. So he called these borderline. And what he found was that actually, yeah, there is still support for this cognitive intelligence hypothesis, because true tool users, like the New Caledonian crow, had a larger brain size than what he called the borderline tool use case or non-tool users, like this pigeon. And we all know that brain size is a really rough measure because we're not necessarily measuring what we want to when we just take total weight. But, you know, you've got to start with somewhere when you're looking across the literature. And he concluded that actually cognitive processes and complex cognition may have repeatedly co-evolved with tool use in several orders of birds. So these were just in birds. So he's saying, okay, so maybe there's a lot of evolution and selection and ecology and morphology involved in tool use, but there's also some evidence that if you use tools, you grow a bigger brain. There's a correlation between brain size and tool use. But interestingly, he also argued that, he found that innovation rate, which is what I'm going to go into next, is the best predictor of borderline tool use. So what he's saying here is that while in true tool use we seem to see some differences, if we take borderline tool use, what it actually seems is that generalized problem solving is the best predictor. So maybe these borderline tool use cases are more like about general intelligence than the true tool users, which may be something about adaptation and selection for that specific behaviour. So now if you're interested in tool use, then I recommend you look at this book, which is fantastic. And there's also been a recent special issue in the Journal of Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, where it's all about tool use as an adaptation. So this argument that we need to think about tool use as in evolutionary ecology and animal behaviour, and take it out of the psychology, take it out of this sort of research on intelligence and the evolution of intelligence. And I'm going to move on to the second half, which is innovation and problem solving. So as I just mentioned before, we had this intriguing result that innovation rate was the best predictor of borderline tool use in birds. So what is innovation rate? What is innovation? So this has sort of been hard to pin down, but this word has come up again and again in behavioral ecology when we started to see behaviors which couldn't be explained any other way. So again, we understand what innovation means in humans, but this is a use of the term to sort of define these kind of new novel behaviors that appear to have been invented in animals, didn't exist before. So this was first really discussed on these observations. This was Kuai, again another famous Japanese primatologist. Back in 1957, he observed these Japanese macaques doing this sweet potato washing behavior. So people would feed them sweet potatoes, tourists or locals, and they were always very sandy. So what the animals started to do was take them down to the sea and wash them in salt water. We only assume that the reason they do that is to remove the sand. Maybe it also gives a nice salty taste. So this was called, when he first described it, proto-culture, because he could see that there was social transmission of the information, but also was an example of animal innovation because it was first started by one young female macaque called Ino, I think it was, that was first observed doing this completely new behavior, and it then spread in the macaques after that. Another famous example is this, and this is the area that I do a lot of my research in, this sort of cognitive behaviors in tits, in parrots, in coal miser, I think they're called here. So this was a milk bottle opening behavior. They first observed it in the 1920s, and it seemed to just be in one location in the south of England where birds were first stealing cream from milk, but then spread over the next 20 years across the country. And so this is completely unlike anything they do in their natural niche. So seems to be an innovation. So why are we interested in this kind of weird animal behavior, I guess you could call it? Well, actually, there's a few reasons. Firstly, the way in which animals solve these sorts of physical problems can be informative for testing understanding and reasoning, and we might be interested in knowing whether non-human animals can show these sorts of reasoning and insight abilities. It comes down to this idea of wanting to understand the theory of mind in humans and in other animals. But in addition to this, problem solving and innovation might tell us something about general behavioral flexibility in species. And this is particularly important when we're thinking about changing environments, because behavioral flexibility has been implicated in the success or failure in species to adapt, for example, to climate change or to urban environments where they're confronted with all these new things and they have to somehow exploit them or die. And that links to the third point there, that actually innovation may well affect the species ecology. So if they can, for example, switch to eating cream off milk bottles, then they might be able to exploit the urban environment and actually may also affect their evolutionary trajectory in the longer term. So if we go back to Jane Goodall, she also gave us a definition for innovation from observing these sorts of completely new behaviours in her chimpanzees. And she said that it could be a solution to a novel problem, a novel solution to an old problem, a signal not observed before, a new ecological discovery, such as a new type of food that wasn't part of the diet before. And note this refers to the outcome. So if it's an unsuccessful innovation, you won't know that it is an innovation. There was a book, which is also very excellent, called Animal Innovation by Simon Reeder and Kevin Leyland in 2003. And they gave us two possible kind of definitions of innovation. So they said, an innovation is a new, modified, learned behavior not previously found in the population. So now we're talking about the behavior, but it still has to be successful for you to observe this. But they also suggested that you could define it through the process. So it's a process that results in a new or modified learned behavior that introduces a novel behavioral variant into a population's repertoire. So note two things. Firstly, this is really hard if you wanted to look at individuals, because you could have individuals repeatedly innovating, but here it only counts the first time one does it, because that's when it introduces it into the population, right? And the second thing to note here is that there's nothing about intelligence here. There's no kind of assumption that you need complex cognition or understanding or reasoning. And so there's a lot of overlap, as I suggested before, between tool use and innovation. And this is one of the ones that I think my favorite example. So we have bait fishing with bread in herons to catch fish, which is considered borderline tool use, maybe innovative, maybe kind of maybe an extension of previous behavior where they would use insects to do this, which in itself may not be learned, but it's learned to change to bread. And then we have this, which seems to be a true innovation in killer whales. So this is one killer whale in captivity that got sick of eating fish and so started to bait fish for herons using fish in a nice sort of roundabout way. So it would keep its fish and then put them on the side of the pool to attract birds. And then when the birds came for the fish, it would grab the birds. Eating birds is not part of a killer whale's natural niche. And this has never been observed anything remotely like it. And so this, what we might call, is a true innovation. And, you know, gets the heron back for its behavior. So what do we think is involved in innovation? So I've already said before that we're not assuming any particularly complex cognition, but there still might be some cognitive mechanisms, which I'll go into. But this is the outline proposed by Sabine Terbich again. And she suggested that actually what is involved in innovation is nothing simple, but rather an interaction between different factors. So in innovation is partly about the opportunity. So there's an opportunity for something new, some novel food, a new challenge. And there's some sort of behavioral interaction between that and your motivation, so how hungry you are maybe, how scared you are of novel objects, your neophilia, how your morphological characteristics, whether you can perceive this new, so some sort of sensory input going in here, and perhaps cognition. And then the outcome is this knowledge that you now have, this product, an innovative behavior, which again, you also have to remember. So that brings in cognition and memory here. So to lay that out more clearly, what's suggested is important is a whole range of behaviors. Your response to novelty, if you're scared of new things, you're never going to innovate anything, right? How exploratory you are, so how likely you are to touch and interact with new objects. How good you are at learning, so and what kind of learning, usually trial and error. Maybe your insight, whether you can look at something that's new and say, oh, I've got a way I can use that in a new way. And maybe some idea of creativity. This has kind of come over from the psychology literature, because who knows what a creative animal is? It's really hard. And then there's some idea of behavioral flexibility in here. So if you're really rigid in your behavior, then you're probably not going to be able to create new behavior very easily. And maybe there's some social processes going on. So I'll talk more about that. We do know that social learning from innovation is one way in which the innovation can spread across the population. But maybe social processes are also involved in how you learn the innovation itself. So I'll just start quickly with the first, with learning and insight. I'll move on to these idea of flexibility and novelty responses. And I'll finish with social processes. So back to our friends, the Goffin cockatoos. So they've used this group in captivity to investigate problem solving by individuals as well. So there's no social learning here, and it's not tools. What we have instead is an incredibly complex lockbox. So there's food in here, but to open that door, the bird has to undo a series of up to, I think, 7 locks. So you have to undo the first lock to get to the second lock, to get to the third lock, and so on. And they train them on this by first giving them, teaching them on each lock separately, and then they put all the locks together, and they have to work out the problem. I think it's really incredible that they can do this, actually. So you had to pull the bar, and then it had to twist that one and pull it off. Now it's got to move the bolt. And then finally, it can open the door and get the food. So what they found with this particular test was that performance was aided by things like neophilia, how willing they were to muck about with the box, but also that birds showed a ratchet-like progress. So they would learn one part and then they would move to the next part and move to the next part beyond that. But what was really cool with the way they did this study was they then mixed up the locks. So suddenly now they're in a different order, or they took bits out, so now the middle lock is missing, which means you don't actually have to do the first locks, because if the middle lock's missing, you can skip straight to the later ones because each lock locks the next lock. Or they kind of did both. So they made it quite complicated in that way. And what they found was actually that birds could deal with this perfectly well. So they were able to, if there was, say, this bar missing, they wouldn't do the part above it. So here you can see there's no need to do this part because this lock is missing, so they go straight for the next one. Or if this wheel is missing, they go straight for that one. And so on. So now the one here is missing, so they're going to the next one. And what they argued that showed was actually that this could allow them to kind of reveal the cognition behind their behavior. So they argued that what they were showing here was insight and means-end reasoning. So what the birds were doing was going to the end and then working their way backwards to the part where it looked like it was the end, and then going forwards again. And this is the way humans reason as well to solve complex problems. So they argued that what they could see here was some form of learned sequences, and it wasn't inflexible or rule-governed, but actually showed real flexible intelligence. Yeah, so moving on from the cognitive part of it, I'm going to talk a bit about these sorts of motivational aspects. So how much behaviour is involved. That's not necessarily intelligence. And to do this, I'm going to use this classic study system. So this is an Indian miner, and they're very invasive. So they're originally from India, as the name suggests, but they're now spread across large parts of the world, in particular in the Australo-Pacific region. There's lots of invasive populations. And they're a really common urban bird in Australia. They're all through your rubbish bins and etc., eating your dog food. They're a real pest. So this study of Andrea Griffin, who's in this part of Australia down here, and she looked at the innovativeness of miners. So we might think our hypothesis is that they're probably pretty innovative because they're so successful at colonizing urban habitats and they seem to be eating all sorts of weird and wonderful foods. So what she did was she tested the willingness of miners brought into captivity to eat new food, to develop new foraging techniques, and she tested their neophobia, their exploration, their motivation, their boldness. So the boldness here is what we'd call a personality trait. So this is basically how willing they are to approach risky situations. Neophobia is their fear of novelty. And exploration is how likely they are to sort of, well, what it says on the tin, to explore new things. And what she found is that, actually, miners are really innovative. No surprises there. But what determines the innovation is actually motivation, neophobia, and exploration. So in particular, birds that were less afraid of new things were more likely to innovate, and birds that were hungrier were more likely to innovate. So there seems to be a real kind of role from just plain old motivation here. But in addition to this, she did a pretty cool study where she created this sort of food box, which had 9 possible ways of accessing it, all which required different techniques. And she gave this to a variety of species, from doves to crows to finches to miners. And what she found was that the latency to open, so the speed in which you open the first compartment, was predicted by your hunger, your motivation, and how persistent you were at just trying. But All others were predicted by age. This is a classic thing. We tend to find younger animals are more innovative. And motor diversity. So this is your kind of ability to manipulate different types of objects. So we have really high motor diversity because we have hands. But not all birds have beaks which can manipulate things, just like I showed you before. So actually, it seemed to be that these things, so foraging in urban environments, could well be associated with innovations that are in turn associated with things like hunger, neophobia, and increased motor diversity. So there's, again, a role for morphology. However, we can also see a role for social processes. So this was work done by in house sparrows by Leica, and actually kind of ties in quite well to what you might get in your collective behavior lectures about wisdom of the crowds. So what they asked is whether being a group living species, a social species, facilitated innovation. So they gave a problem-solving task to small and large groups of sparrows. And what they found was that in large groups of sparrows, they were likely to solve the task faster, and it was better for the whole group. So all members of the food got grouped faster than in the small groups. So they suggested that there was some sort of skill pool effect here happening, where maybe different members of the group showed different levels of skills, maybe because of their past experience. They just happened to encounter something like this before. And they were sort of able to put that together and come up with an innovation. So, and this could also be combined with these other motivational factors. So, for example, maybe you had a particularly good problem solver in the group, but you also had a particularly neophilic bird in the group. The neophilic bird could approach the task fast, but then not know how to solve it. But the fact that it's approached the task fast will then facilitate the good problem solver to have a go, and then the whole group gets the problem solved because of the interaction between those two individuals. But interestingly, what they also found was that urban groups were more successful than rural groups. And I'll go into this in a couple of slides. But I first want to say that this study was sort of repeated in a way in a natural situation in these tits, in the coal miser. And they looked at them in the wild. So here they were pit tagged, and so this is they were microchipped, and it was all recorded on these electronics here so they could measure it in the wild. And what they found was that larger flocks of birds were more likely to solve again. And the presence of at least one experienced bird that had encountered a problem like this before increased the frequency of solving. So basically, this was empirical evidence for what they call, as I said, the skill pool or pool of competence innovation hypothesis. And this is an idea that large groups are more diverse, and so they can innovate more efficiently and contain more potential solvers. And this is actually an idea which is really prevalent in economics, you know, arguments about we should have more diverse committees because that means they're more likely to be better at problem solving than ones where everyone's the same. Well, we see it in animals too. And I should say that recent work has challenged this, so the debate continues whether this is a real effect. So let's go back to where we ended the first section and ask whether or not we see evidence for this sort of behaviour linked with innovation when we look across species rather than within species. So this is a sort of two arms of behavioural ecology. We can do within species studies looking at natural variation experiments to explain that or to unpick what we think is causal, and then comparative studies to twin with that, where we look across species and see if the pattern still holds up. And it's a really powerful way to put those together to sort of come up with a real answer. So they did this, again, a group with Louis Lefebvre, where they asked, okay, do innovators have larger brains? And they found, yes, that brain size in birds correlates with the foraging innovations that have been reported. So this is just collecting reports that people have made of the innovations they've seen in those birds. So they might report to the local ornithology group that they've seen a bird using opening milk bottles or learning how to open supermarket doors by waiting where the automated machine is or whatever. So they put all of these together and found that actually, yeah, it seemed to correlate with brain size across species. And they tested two hypotheses for why this might be. First, what's called the technical intelligence hypothesis, or secondly, the opportunistic generalism intelligence hypothesis, that generalist species will be better at this. And what they found was that the diversity of technical innovations displayed by bird families was a much better predictor of residual brain size than the number of food type innovations. So this is separating out an innovation where you're solving a problem, for example, opening a milk bottle to get cream, versus an innovation of I'm learning to eat a new food type, so say minor birds eating dog food. And they found that the first one of those first types of innovations, was a much better predictor of brain size. So this sort of argues for this technical intelligence idea rather than a generalist intelligence. And they suggested that, yeah, actually there was some sort of cognitive capacity underlying innovation rate. And in addition to this, they found good evidence, also from Kevin Leyland and Simon Reeder again, that innovation rate correlated with some of these other forms of learning. So with learning speed, with reversal learning, so this is an idea of how flexible you are in your learning once you've learnt something, can you change it to something else? Whether you're able to solve problems in experiments, and actually whether you use tools. So it's all coming back. So it really suggests that there's a whole lot involved in what we call animal innovation. Doesn't make it any less interesting, but does make it pretty complex. There's some role for cognition, there's some role for behaviour, there's some role for morphology, there's some role for opportunity. So let's have a quick think about the consequences for ecology. So one of the hypothesized benefits is that it allows animals to exploit a wider variety of resources, especially when resources are in shortage, exactly the same as the tool use hypothesis. And actually, what we do see is that generalist species and invasive species tend to be more innovative, which is sort of arguing for this pattern. And a final thing I want to say here, I'll just skip over this one, is that we also see a lifestyle associated with innovative. So innovative species tend to have a broader diet, be resident and not migratory, don't cache food, and to be social. So we're sort of building up a picture here of the sort of species that lives in unpredictable or variable environments and has to find ways to find a wide variety of food in those environments. In addition to this, we tend to find that juveniles are more innovative than adults, arguing for some further link with the sort of hunger or motivation hypothesis. So necessity drives evolution is what this has been called, because juveniles are usually hungrier than adults. And the final thing I want to say here is that we do see a really cool link with urban environments. So urban species tend to be more innovative, and we see more innovations in species that live in urban environments. And in addition to that, if we look across species, we see that species that have moved into urban environments tend to have larger residual brain sizes than species that haven't been able to invade urban environments. So we have here what we might call like a full circle. So traits displayed regularly across species and expressed with little learning, like some tool use, for example, in woodpecker finches, don't require mental capabilities, but they also don't exclude mental capabilities. And skills acquired by known principles of learning, like trial and error learning, don't also require any special explanations. Flexible, rare, innovative behaviour, including some tool use, is by definition hard to study in the wild, but actually it might be really illuminating regarding cognitive operations, and there's some way, and we can use this to actually look at look at things like causal reasoning and insight in these species. It's a really good mechanism to understand that. But the final thing I really want to say is that what I've told you here is all being currently under debate. So I'm a behavioural ecologist, so I give you explanations which for me make sense because they make sense in the light of evolution and ecology of species. But if you talked to an anthropologist or a primatologist or a psychologist, they may well give you a very different argument. They might tell you that actually this is all a load of bollocks and that tool use is something which in primates is related to complex cognition and is intrinsically linked into the development of large brains in humans. This may also be true, but basically it's a very active debate, and you need to make up your own minds. If you're interested, do more reading and basically come to your own conclusions, because I can only give you one side of this debate. And yeah, you can find references. Also, I can give you references if you're interested. So yeah, we're all done.